Now, I was thinking the other day about all the different four-letter words that you have probably heard in your lifetime and that I've heard in mine. Hopefully, we haven't used any of them recently. And out of all these four-letter words, free is the one that actually has just such a positive vibe to it. It's a word that whenever you think about it, it's one of those that you just kind of pause for a minute, especially when it's not a request being made of you, but it's an offer being given to you. That whenever free is associated with that offer, that you just kind of pause, you tend to just settle a little bit, and you listen a little bit more closely, you're a little more engaged, you're a little more interested in what someone has to say or the offer that they're making. Isn't that true? Isn't that how that word works? Free is a word that you don't hear said a whole lot, but whenever you do, and it is in the form of a request, I know for me personally, I've found that a few of these requests, I tend to really, you just have me making these offers or these requests with free in it. And so I want to share with you a couple of those that I thought of, and there are more, and I'm sure you probably have yours as well. But one of the requests that I've actually thought of, that whenever anyone has stated this to me or made this request, or I'm sorry, given me the offer, not the request, but the offer with free associated with it, this is one of those that for me personally, I tend to kind of stop. My knees get a little weak, and I start going, man, that's fairly intriguing. And this is one of those these offers that, whenever free is associated with it, that it doesn't really matter if it's in written form, if it's a text, an email, a phone call, or if it's face-to-face. It's just, it's one of those I stop. Here's what it is. It's when someone offers me free food. Isn't that, any of you with me on that? Yeah, yeah. And hey, look, here's a couple of reasons for that. One is, if it's good free food, you have my attention. I like good free food. But the other reason why, and some of you know my family, you would probably guess this just from rough math or fuzzy math, is that when you start adding all the mouths that I have to feed in my home, there's four kids and then Melissa and myself, there's six total. Whenever free food is offered to me, you've got us, okay? So I'm just letting you know that. You pretty much, I'm interested, okay? The other one I was thinking about, and this is one that is an offer that, especially right now, probably resonates given the time of the year that it is, and it's associated with taxes, tax-free. How many of you like tax-free? Yeah, yeah, right? Tax-free. Whenever I've heard that there are certain offers being made that's tax-free, such as furniture ads for selling furniture, cars, or whatever, they're going to pay your taxes for you. And just as a footnote, you all know that that's a gimmick, right? I hope you know that. It makes you feel better, but anyway. But whenever you hear something is tax-free, you're far more inclined and far more interested to just kind of stop, scan the page, look at the ad, and even if it's not something you need, you're interested. Isn't that true? Because it's something that's free. I enjoy when I hear about tax-free shopping weekends for the kids when they go back to school and you get the tax-free weekends, you can go buy supplies and clothing and maybe computers, or if you're a student here, that's one of the things you get interested in. The other thing that I like are Roth IRAs. Any of you have a Roth IRA here? Yeah, man, you're talking about investing after-tax dollars, and it grows tax-free until you retire. Now, some of us are probably going to be really, really old when we retire, if we get there, but either way, you don't pay Uncle Sam a dime of it. So free is just, it's just one of those words that, for me, when it's in an offer, I really, really am intrigued by. Now, the other thing about free is free is a word that when you look up the definition of it, it really just means this: to not be restrained, to not be held back. So when you think through it, just relatively speaking, where you're at in your life, and no matter where you're at today, what you've been through recently, or you know someone's been through something, whatever the situation is, you have likely heard someone, or you have thought this in your own life, that you wish you were free from something. Haven't you? Recently, I know in our past 5 weeks, we've spoken about personal finances, and we spoke a little bit about debt. And I've had some individuals, friends of mine, I've thought it myself before, that said, man, I wish I was free of debt or debt-free. Have you ever thought that? Man, and in essence, when we say that, here's what we're saying, right? Is I wish that the strain and the stress and the pressure of debt would just go away. I wish it would just fly off and leave me. I've heard recently some other friends and even family members that have told me that over the past couple of months that they've been sick for like weeks consecutively. Have you seen that? Like upper respiratory issues, sinus issues, and stuff like that. Been to the doctor multiple times, had shots, had prescriptions, the whole thing. And what you hear a lot of times, they'll say, man, I cannot wait until I am free of sickness. I can't wait till it leaves my home, never to return. Just go out there, leave me alone, right? Some of you are dealing with aches and pains, and you'll say, I wish I could just be pain-free. Just get rid of the neck pain, for example, that I've been battling with, or whatever your ailments have been. So the word free can be used in so many contexts and in so many ways, but it always carries with it something that is a relief to you. It's something that's coming away or going away from you that you want off of you. Some of you, it may be right now that you wish you were free from your job, where you could go to other opportunities that were better. Some of you may wish that you were free from some certain relationship strife that you find yourself in. That could be family related, it could be job related, friendships, whatever. Some of you, just in any circumstance, you're thinking, I wish I could be free from this. Now, there's another phrase I thought of to turn it back positive, and it kind of goes in the same line, where I was thinking about freedom, and it's associated with another word that I think we all are interested in, and it's time. Free time. You with me? Free time. I remember as a child going to elementary school. And for some of us, that's been recent. For some of us, that's been a pretty long time. But hopefully we can all kind of go back there. You go back to that point and you think about when you started school as just a little kid, and when you had your classes and your teacher would teach you and you had all these things. I remember one of my favorite phrases was when the teacher would say, we're going to go out on the playground and have free time. Didn't you? I mean, I just looked forward to it. I was absolutely excited, ecstatic about going out on the playground and having free time, to where I could go and swing across the monkey bars if I wanted to. I could get on the teeter-totter. I could go swing. I could do whatever I wanted to. I could run around, throw dirt. It didn't matter. And whatever I wanted to do, right? Girls, y'all didn't probably do that, but the guys did. And then we'd fight and, you know, all that stuff. But in my free time, the way that I envisioned that, the way I understood it was, is that all my other time was taken from me. But this was that block of time that was for me. In essence, you could say this was me time. This was time for me to where I could do what brought energy to my life, what I enjoyed. It was just for me to do whatever in the heck I wanted to do. That was the way I saw free time. Well, I was thinking even later in life, and I think we all would agree that free time is something we all value. Every one of us in here probably wish you had more of it, don't you? And I was thinking recently about some of the things I like to do in my free time in my adulthood. And one of these is it's a sport. And I don't get to do it near as much as I used to because of busyness. But it was a sport, and the sport is called golf. Any of you golfers here? Guys or girls? All right. Yeah, this is, now we're talking. Okay, now you're awake if you're a golfer. Everybody else just went to sleep. Now the golfers are engaged, okay? And so in my free time, I decided that golf was something that was me time, and it was time for me to go and do something that I really enjoyed. Well, the thing about my golf experience is kind of shady. I have a shady background with golf. Because I was taught how to play golf by my grandfather, who was a professional golfer, but he died when I was around in high school. So I didn't play for a number of years. And around my college age, I decided I was going to try to pick up golf again. So when I did this, it was me and all my buddies, and we would go out. And if you saw this, if there was a hidden camera, it would have been really funny to show. And we would get out there and go out on a course, because who needs to practice, right? It's like Allen Iverson. Man, it's just practice. You know, you don't need to do that. And so you just get out there and you just put the ball down, you just whack it. And then that's how you learn. That was our approach. Well, one day I had a good friend of mine, though, that invited me to go play. He was a good golfer. And he said his buddy, and I'm not going to mention his name in case he ever watches this, but his buddy was going to go play with us, a guy I'd never met. So we'll call him Bob. Okay? That's an easy name. No offense if you're here and your name's Bob. My buddy invited us. And you'll see why in a minute. My buddy invited both of us to go out to go play golf. And I was like, okay. I was like, okay, now you know I'm a little rough around the edges, okay? I'm polishing my game. He's like, no, it'd be fun. So we went out there. We drove up to the first tee. We got on the tee box. You know, we're swinging and all this stuff. I put my tee in the ground, put the ball on the ground. I line up. And one thing I did remember my grandfather taught me is it's all in the grip. So if you ever want to learn how to golf, you need to get the perfect grip. So I was working on my grip. And as I started just kind of adjusting my grip, I accidentally tapped the ball. And so I just was like, okay. And I leaned over and put the ball back on the tee. When I stood up, Bob's looking at me and he said, that's one. And I looked at him and I just laughed. I thought, yeah, okay. And he said, that's one. And I said, one what? He says, one stroke. I was like, okay, whatever. So I just lined up. I hit a terrible shot and I thought, okay, whatever. What I ended up finding out that day was that those 4 hours I carved out to play golf in my free time or my me time, something I was looking for refreshment from, energizing, you know, some type of energizing effort in this golf, some type of just enjoying myself, turned out to be, I won't say the word in church, but it was just bad, okay? It was so bad. This guy, at every hole and at every play, he reminded me of all the PGA standard rules, all of them. He pushed down on me, and he would just sit there and check on everything I did, and it was a miserable, miserable experience for me. And when I was leaving that day, and I went over, and of course, I was such a bad golfer, I didn't have golf shoes, so I didn't have to change shoes. We're going back over to the cars, and he was over there changing his shoes, taking off his golf shoes, because he's a pro, right, in his own mind. And he's over there, and we're getting ready to leave. He said, "Guys, I enjoyed it. I'm about to do this again." I remember looking at him going, "There's no way." Right? There is no way. Because why would I take my free time to go and be a part of something and do something when some dude is so hung up with himself and hung up with rules and hung up with regulations that he completely killed and destroyed all the fun, all the enjoyment, all the refreshing feelings and emotions that I was longing for in my free time? Why would I ever do that? What's been interesting for me, and I know this about you, is true as well, is that many of us, when we're working, and all of us work here. If you're a mom that stays home, you work, right? I hear an amen. All of you girls that work outside the home and inside, you work far more hard than us guys do. And it's a lot harder job. And all of you guys that are working as well and having jobs and all the things you're doing, what most of us find ourselves doing is living to work for the weekend. Is that true? It's like, if I can just get through Monday to Friday and get to the weekend, then I get my free time. Is that the way it is? Saturday, Sunday, you know, hang out with family, hang out with friends, watch football, go out and go to movies, whatever you do, play golf, whatever you do. And so that's what you live for. But what another thing that we've seen is that people throughout years here in this country have actually carved out in an hour to 2 hours on a weekend to take some of their free time to invest it in another thing that they thought was being value-added or replenishing or re-energizing in their life, and it's called gathering together in a spiritual sense for worship, church. For many of us in here that grew up in the years prior to myself, that you're my parents' age, that's just the thing to do, wasn't it? It's just everyone pretty much carved out of their free time on Sundays, or maybe Saturdays today, but on Sundays, at least an hour to two, to go and spend time at church. And that's just what you did. And what you saw in this was that this right here is worth it. This is an investment. This is something that I have a need for, I have a desire for with God. And so because of that, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this and to find that energy and that refreshment and all those things in your free time. But interesting, what I find interesting is that over the past 10, 15 years, and it's been a trend for quite some time now, what we're finding is that more and more we're seeing people that when they get to the weekend, they're literally saying, "I don't really find that it is value added for me to carve out time on my Sunday to go and experience church or a spiritual gathering of sorts on the weekend." See, back in the day, more people, it was almost like two groups, okay? And I think I'm defining this properly. You had those that were spiritual that went to church, and you had those that didn't, who were typically off in some area of lifestyle issues or sin, what you call sin or things like that. So you had kind of two groups. What's interesting today is that now we have this third group. We're finding more and more that, sure, you have this little pocket of individuals over here that say, "I really don't really care. I'm just going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to go to church. I'm going to live how I want to live," and that type of thing. You have those over here that are really hung up with carving out of their free time to go to church. And now we're seeing this big movement of individuals that were over here in church that are saying, "I'm no longer going to do that deal, and I'm going home." That I no longer see that it is value added, that it's no longer worth my while to go to church. And when you dig a little deeper, because it's kind of confusing, because, you know, it's easy the other way. Those that really love God, those that seemingly don't. Well, now you have this middle group, and this middle group saying, "Hey, I love God. Hey, I love Jesus. I have no problem with God or Jesus. What I have a problem with is what some term to be organized religion." I feel like that when you really get down to it and you look at my weekend and when you look at the little bit of time, the free time that I have, that for me to take that free time and to carve it out and keep doing this that I've been doing for weeks, months, years, decades, I just don't feel like that it's working. You're seeing that more and more. To the point to where today, that they say only 26% of our nation literally goes to church on a given Sunday. 26. In our city, at best, it's 30, 35%. So there's this movement. There's this movement where people are pushing back. And they're saying it's no longer worth their time. And when, you know, the dust settles, because this is a pretty emotional issue for some, but when the dust settles and when you really kind of dig deep, and especially that middle group, and you start going, well, why not? I mean, what do you mean it's not fulfilling you and all these things? Here's what they'll say. They'll say, hey, I have a longing to connect with my Heavenly Father. I have a longing to know God. I have a longing to experience God. But when I go out here and I experience this being offered today, in many cases, I don't feel like that I'm being refreshed. I don't feel like I'm being renewed. I feel like something's missing. You know, that may be your story. You're just coming back to church, or you've been out of church for a while, you've been bouncing around in churches. It may have been that throughout your life, that's been you. It's, man, I love God. I really want to connect with God, but this system, when I go, it just feels like it is life-draining, not life-giving. And that's been your experience. What's very intriguing to me is that many of us probably don't know this, or maybe we haven't really connected dots before, but when Jesus, his 3 years, 3.5 years of his ministry, at the end of his life, he was literally in a culture very, very similar to that of our nation. Now, it was unique and it was different, but it was similar when you think about it. Jesus was actually born in a nation that was founded on religion, Judaism. It was founded through a covenant that God made one-to-one with a guy by the name of Abraham thousands of years before. And he founded this nation. He said, Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. The numbers and the descendants from this nation are going to be so great that the grains of the seashore and the stars of the sky, it's going to be that number and greater. And so Israel was born years later. This nation came into power. It experienced seasons of highs and seasons of lows. It experienced a lot of religious fervor, and it experienced times where religion was just messed up, and everything was going left and right and sideways, and paganism and idol worship and all this stuff. And then they also experienced the blessings of God at times and what seemed to be the curses of God. So Jesus is walking around in this time, and this was actually a time that seemingly was a time of renewal in the nation of Israel. It was a time to where that people started moving back towards the truth of Judaism, the law as they understood it, the Old Testament. And as they started moving back towards this, and as they started trying to do this, what you found was is that certain religious leaders started getting into places of leadership called Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, scribes, lawyers, all these people. And these were basically the preachers of their day. And what they started doing is when they started going around, they started calling all these people to quit turning your back on God and to make sure you do this and this and this and this. And it was all about practice. All these rules, all these regulations, all these things. Actually, there were over 615 of them. You can imagine that. And when all this started taking place, all these people who thought back to their history and thought back to all the things that they went through, highs and lows, and when it all seemed to, you know, figure out and start going south, they started going, okay, we need to do this. So many people, many of your common people in modern day Israel started living and practicing all these religious things in their society. So Jesus walks into this nation, and Jesus starts engaging these people. And believe it or not, when Jesus started speaking, you had the individuals over here who didn't go to synagogue, or in our case, go to church, that were absolutely attracted to Jesus. You had the middle group that were trying to do the right things, but they weren't the religious elite, this big group of people that were drawn to Jesus. And then you had these religious leaders, these elite people that were drawn to Jesus to hear what he had to say. And so Jesus would go out, and in essence, here's what Jesus did. Jesus would look at those that were far from God in the sense that they were just kind of living and saying, hey, I know I'm far from God. And he'd say, you're missing. He'd go to the middle group, and when he would teach, in so many ways, he'd look at them and he'd say, you're missing. And then he would go over here to the religious elite, the Pharisees, the people who knew everything about the law, the people who memorized just tons and tons and tons of the Bible, and he would look at them and he'd go, you're missing it. Jesus came in, and I'm telling you, in a highly religious culture, he broke down the categories. He tore it all down. He said, guys, some of you think you get it. You think because you have all these rules, you think because you have these phylacteries and all this scripture that you've memorized and that you're so, you know, sharp and you have all these different adornments, the way you dress yourself, you think you get it? You don't. Guys, you over here, you know you don't get it because those that are over there that think they get it, that tell you how much you don't get it, you don't get it? Yeah, you're right. You don't get it. That makes sense? I couldn't say it again. But and then he goes to that middle group, and as they're drawn to him, they knew something wasn't right either because they're going, okay, I'm doing these things, I'm not doing that, and I'm still feeling like something's missing. And what Jesus came and what he did, let me tell you. Jesus came, and the first thing he wanted people to understand was this: God wants for you to be free from religion. God wants for you to be free. See, religion is hollow. Religion is empty. Rules, procedures, do this, do that, legalism, checklist living. The way that my friend Bob held me to on the golf course was sucking the life out of the game. And that is what Jesus said. He said, This legalism, this Phariseeism, this garbage over here, that is religion. And there's no life in it. He would go to the individuals over here who were just completely pushed away and ran away from this form of religion. And he'd say, there's no life in that either. So Jesus, when he would do these things and say these things, and there's so much that you could study and you could see about what he did. The people who were over here that were really messed up in their life, that were doing all the wrong things, they were like, wow, this guy's a breath of fresh air. He doesn't condemn me. He doesn't judge me. He doesn't speak down to me. He just speaks. He seems to care. The people in the middle group kind of thought, this isn't seemingly satisfying me, so he's saying things that to me seem to really just address something I'm really craving. And this group over here, the religious elite, were hacked off. Very, very, very angry. Because the system that they were in, the rules and regulations that they lorded over people, Jesus was attacking it. He was taking away their power. He was challenging their influence. He was challenging something that I believe we're going to see today, that unfortunately today, I believe that in our country, even across the globe, even in your life and in my life, is something that's in the heart that we battle with. You have your Bibles. I want you to turn with me. Luke chapter 15. We're going to look at a story. And you have probably heard of this story. It's a parable. And when Jesus told parables, his parables were made up stories where he would have characters in the story that represented who he was speaking to. That's what parables were. But there was this really strong truth that Jesus is trying to communicate. But there was an occasion where Jesus was speaking. And when Jesus was speaking, as on every occasion, generally, people started crowding around. Look with me at Luke 15, verse 1 through 3. Watch this. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him. To who? To Jesus. Verse 2. And the Pharisees, the religious elite and the scribes, they sat over there and they grumbled to themselves. They were just talking, being negative. They said, this man receives sinners and eats with them. That Jesus is sitting here and he starts to speak and tax collectors and sinners started coming to Jesus, flocking to Jesus. You know you have a religious culture when you come up with phrases and words to talk about certain groups of people and what their lifestyle is. You know as well as I do today, we have that in our culture, don't we? These Pharisees are watching this happen and here they are and they go, see that? Those guys, he hangs out with them. And not only that, he eats with them. And eating with someone back then would just show full acceptance of that person. And they said, how could he do this? If he's from God, he would never do this. Never would he ever do that. And so as they said that, Jesus, of course, knowing what they're saying and watching the scowls on their face and the grumbling, Jesus launches into these parables. And he tells two quick parables that we won't read. You can read them when you get home. He talks about things that are lost, a lost coin, and lost sheep. And these were kind of like volleys to the people that were listening, the Pharisees and the others. And in essence, here's what he said. He said, isn't it true in life that whenever you find that your coin is lost for the dowry for your daughter, you'll turn heaven and upside down to try to find that coin so your daughter can be married? And they're all like, yeah. And he said, hey, when you find that coin, aren't you elated? They go, yeah. He said, that's the same thing with God. When someone's lost, when someone's a sinner, when someone's way out here far from God and they know they are, Jesus said, God gets pumped when they come to him, when he finds them, when they're no longer lost. Says the same thing about sheep. And then Jesus gets ready. And probably by this point, the Pharisees are sitting here and they're going, okay, well, in this case, we've escaped the stories of Jesus, the parables of Jesus. He's not going to bring us into this one. Then you jump down to verse 11 with me. Jesus sets up this new story. Listen, follow with me. Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. And so, follow me, in this crowd, you have the religious haves, the too good, and then you have the very bad. And Jesus said, there's a father, speaking of God, who has a really, really good son and a really, really bad one. That's what he says. Follow me. And the younger of them said to his father, the younger brother said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And without boring you too much, here was the deal. Back then, what you owned in your land and all of your assets was pretty much everything. And in this story, in their culture, Jesus said this younger son goes to his dad and he says, Dad, I want for us to just pretend. I want you to pretend for a moment that you're dead. I want my share of the inheritance. And because there were three of them, the father and then the two sons, what that meant was is that the father would cash out what he had and split it three ways and go ahead and give at least this one portion of his inheritance to this son, as he would when he died. Now, can you imagine being a dad or a mom and your kids coming to you and saying, hey, Dad, I don't really care about the relationship. I just want what you have. Will you give it to me? So look what Jesus said. He said, so he asked for it, and he divided his property between them. The dad looks at him and says, okay. He goes and he cashes out and he gives this younger son his inheritance. Continue verse 13. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. Then immediately after getting his cash, the young guy said, I can't wait to get out of here. I'm gone. He packs his stuff and he takes off. And you know where he goes? This is what Jesus is telling in the story. Most likely to a Gentile nation. That is a group of people that to a Jewish individual were unclean. They were not really fit in God's, they didn't really fit in God's kingdom or any of that or in God's equation. And so this guy, he takes his money and he goes. And then he continues. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. What did that mean? In essence, what he said was, he went out there, he took all of his money and he just blew it. He had parties. He had lots of friends that wanted to get in on his parties. When he would go to the local whatever, he would buy for everybody. Whatever the situation was, he squandered his money in reckless living. Verse 14. And when he had spent what? Everything. Everything. A severe famine arose in that country. He began to be in need. And I'm sure that when Jesus was telling this story, the religious elite that are sitting here again, arms crossed, listening, that when they heard this part of the story, they go, all right, that's exactly what he deserved. He told his dad he was dead in his mind. Give me my money, and I'm going to leave with it, and I'm going to live how I want to live. And so these guys immediately are connecting dots. Okay, that's that group of people over there. And so now the famine hits. So that shows that God, in this story, is disciplining his son. That's what they thought. So verse 15, because he was in need, he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And you may be thinking, I would never want to feed pigs. Well, you would never want to feed pigs in a much lower level than someone that was a Jewish individual that was told they had to feed pigs. In their day, ceremonially, That was one of the nastiest things that they could ever do. It was one of those things that you never did. But because this guy was desperate, he said, I've got to provide for myself to be able to survive in this famine. So what he does is he goes off and he gets someone there in that Gentile nation to hire him to go and feed this guy's pigs. And then I'm sure the Pharisees are sitting there going, right on, what he deserves. Verse 16. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate. This guy was starving. And no one gave him any. No one. So this is a worst case scenario, isn't it? Guy gets what he wants, runs from his father, blows it all, becomes desperate, in a famine, needs something. Verse 17, Jesus continues. But when he came to himself, or when this guy finally came to his senses, here's what he said. He said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But here I am, and I'm perishing with hunger. He said, the slaves that work for my dad, they have plenty of food to eat. I left my dad. I thought I could go out and do this on my own. I didn't think I needed my dad. But his slaves, his servants, they have more than I have. Verse 18, he says, I will arise, and I will go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I sinned against heaven and again before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. So this was his plan. He thought, you know what? It is better for me to go crawling back on my knees to my dad and say, Dad, I know I don't deserve anything from you. I know I told you you're dead to me. I told you I don't need you. All I want is what I can get from you. I know that. And because of that, I've sinned against you. I've sinned against heaven. And so here's what I want, God, Dad. Will you just let me be your servant? Will you let me just sleep in outside? Will you just let me serve you? The guy was broken. The guy was messed up. The guy knew that the only reason why he cared about his dad at first was what he could get from him. Now he was at a point where he said, no, I care more about just going back and just being with my father. Just being there. That's all I want. I know I don't deserve it. And so he came up with this plan. So in verse 20 it says, and he arose and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and he felt compassion. And then he ran and he embraced him and he what? And culturally today, we struggle with this, but a Palestinian man in that day would run nowhere unless his life was being threatened. It was undignified to ever pick up your robe and to run anywhere. Boys would do it, kids would do it, but a man would never do it. A dignified man would never do it. And it says that when the father saw his son approaching, he ran. He ran to his son. He was filled with compassion. He embraced his son. He kissed his son. And I'm sure his son probably had to look like death, right? Starving, helping with the pigs and all this junk. This kid had to look awful, and his dad loved him. And his dad ran to him, and he kissed him. At this point, I'm sure the Pharisees over here and the religious elite were thinking, what? This is going the totally opposite direction of what I thought it was. Jesus continues. And then the son started to go through his spiel. Here's what he said. He said, verse 21, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And before he could get the words out of his mouth, that I'll just be a slave. I'll be a servant to you, Dad. I'll take the scraps. I'll take the leftovers. I'll serve you the rest of my life. I'll do whatever you want me to do. Before he could get that out of his mouth, look at verse 22. But the father stopped him. He said this, servants, bring quickly the best robe. Who had the best robe? Father. Go get my best robe. Go get my best suit and bring it out here. He said, and put it on him. And put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And then bring the fattened calf. And this never happened. This never happened. Bring the fattened calf. Because my son, who had just took everything and told me I was dead to him, has come back. Get the fattened calf. Bring this puppy out and let's have a good time. And then he continues. And let's kill it, eat it, and celebrate. For this, my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. At this point in the story, as Jesus is saying this, and this is recorded by Luke, a physician, who's getting word for word what took place from Mark. And he's recording this for them. that the Pharisees and the religious guys are sitting there and they're going, okay, the father is God. The younger brother's clearly those guys. He said he had two sons, so whatever. And so this is the point where Jesus probably leans over like I'm about to. He gets his cup of wine or grape juice, whichever one you think he had. And he swigged it, okay, to get his throat ready. Because this is the point where he's about to transition the story. This is the point where oftentimes when you've heard this talk, you didn't hear this part. There was very little emphasis about this. But he had two sons. Not one. He had two. Verse 25. Now his older brother, or the son, was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. Now, if any of you are against dancing, there you go. Okay? I'm just saying. Jesus is saying they were dancing. All right? That's all I'm going to say about it. But he heard this. He heard the music, the blaring, okay, and the dancing. He heard all this just ruckus. And so he called one of the servants. And he asked him, what does these things mean? What's going on? You know, what's Dad doing in there? And he said to him, your brother has come. Your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. Look at the older brother's response. But he was angry. And he refused to go in. This older brother, as he approached and he saw the house, and he heard the music, heard the dancing, probably smelled the aroma of the fattened calf. And as he's coming up there and he's going, what in the world? I mean, did I do that good of a job today? You know, what's going on? And so he calls his servant and he says, listen, dude, your brother's back. Really? Yeah. And your dad's so pumped about it. Your dad's so excited about it. He killed the fattened calf. He slapped his best robe on him. He took him in there and we're partying. Come on. He said, no way. There's no way I'm going in there to celebrate because of that jerk. There's no way that I'm going to go in there and put myself around a guy like him. And the older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. Continue verse 29 or 28. So his father came out and he entreated him. The father hears probably from the servant coming back in and said, hey, he's outside, but he won't come. He seemed a little upset. So the dad gets up and he walks out to his son. He said, hey, come on. Let's do this together. Let's have this family time together. Let's celebrate, man. Let's get together. He entreated him. Come on. But he answered his father, look. In essence, he looked at his dad. This is the attitude of it. He said, look, Dad. These many years I've served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. He's like a spoiled brat, doesn't he? He's like, Dad, listen. There is no way I'm going in there. Because look at all the stuff I've done for you. I've done everything the way you want me to do it. I've done it perfectly. I've obeyed the rules. I've worked your fields. I've done everything. And then this sucker comes home, and look what you do for him. You've never done that for me. You've never done that for me. I'm not going to do it. Verse 30. But when this son of yours came, who had devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. Dad, he was out there with prostitutes using your money. That's what he was doing. And you go kill the calf? This is like worst case scenario. Unbelievable. Wouldn't happen. Then he told him, son, you were always with me. All that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and to be glad, for this, your brother, was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. You know, oftentimes when we hear that story when we've read it, and maybe it's been a little while since you've read that story, you've always heard it said, the prodigal son. You know, the truth behind the story is it's the prodigal son. In this story, when Jesus was speaking to his audience, he was putting into this story the elder brother, the one that stayed home, that obeyed the rules, the regulations, did everything right. It was on a performance-based thing with his father. And then the one that was just the jerk and the nut job who went to his dad and said, let's play like your dad. Give me your money. I'm going to do what I want to do. And what Jesus is presenting here is this. Whoever would listen. There are two different religions here. There's a religion of what I deserve because of what I've done. And there is a religion here of I'm going to go do what I want to do. And what Jesus is showing here in this story, and what he's communicating to them, is that you're missing it. You're missing it. You think that this relationship with the Father is all about you getting what you want to do, getting what you can from the Father based on how you perform and the way you do what you do. And he looks at the other one. He said, and your relationship with the Father was based on you getting what you could get from him to go do what you wanted to do. In both cases, in both scenarios, both were lost. Both were empty. And in front of these people, right, those far from God clearly in society, those that were the middle group trying to figure this thing out, those that were religious elite, Jesus just blew apart their religious system. Jesus said, I'm here to tell you. You think God owes you. You think that because you go to church or synagogue, because you tithe, because you do all this and this and this and this, that before your Father, you can say, look at me, Dad. Look at all what I've done for you. I deserve what you give me. And Jesus said, you're just as lost as he is. You're just as selfish as he is. You're just as manipulative as he is. What Jesus showed here, and this is so awesome, don't miss it. The Father in both cases with both sons went out to them. When he saw the one that had gone off and just lived like heck, that everyone clearly could see was wrong, Jesus says that the Father ran to him. He didn't let the son get to him. He went to him. He said, son, I love you. I want you to come home. I don't care what you've done. I don't really care to hear it. All I know is you were lost. Now you're here. You're found. I love you. I don't love you because of what you've done or what you haven't done. I love you because of who you are. And in this story, Jesus clearly communicates that in the system of religion and in a system of rules and thou shalt and thou shalt not, it's a confusion. And in the heart of every person, we crave, we long, we desire for the God of heaven, our Father, to connect with us. And even though we have done stuff that is so despicable, God said, and I'm willing to forgive you because you're broken, because you want me. You didn't come back for what I could give you. You came back for me. You came back because you want me. Then Jesus looked here and says that the father went and entreated the older brother. He said, I want you to come in too. I want for you to come in. I love you. I don't want you out there. I don't want you angry. I don't want you bitter. I don't want any of that. I want you to come in too. Sadly, in this story, the older brother said, look, I don't have to put up with it. Because I know what I've done. I know what I deserve. In both cases, they needed the Father. You know, when I think about what we're experiencing today in our world, in our country, the movements we're seeing of de-churched, unchurched people and others that are kind of that middle crowd that say, I do love God, I do love Jesus, just not getting it. People that are over here that have just never been to church, left church, church is not their deal, God's necessarily not their deal, that really know by society that they are kind of marginalized and outsiders. And even the ones that are over here that weekly get together and do and do and do and focus and focus and focus and practice, practice, practice and stick their chest out a little bit because they think they're better. What I really believe that God's doing today is God is making it so clear that if we're really, really honest with ourselves, something is missing. If you're one of these that's just off in sin and you're living a life that is so far from God, you know something's missing. No one has to tell you. But what Jesus is saying is, Father loves you. He wants you to come home. You're in that middle crowd, you're confused. You're saying, I don't want to go there because I know that doesn't make it happen. But I don't want to go there because I know that didn't seem to make it happen. Jesus said, there's another way. It's not based off of what you haven't done or what you do. It's based on just the Father. He wants you. And if you're one of those individuals that for whatever reason that you have felt that because I go to church, because I'm a morally good person, because I do these things, haven't done those things, that I want or I deserve heaven, or I deserve this relationship with God, Jesus is saying, no, you really don't. In the kingdom of God, there is no pride. In the kingdom of God, we're all the same. It doesn't matter what category you find yourself in.